sun down, you better take care. If I find you've been creeping round my back stairs, sun down, you better take care. If I find you've been creeping round my back stairs, sometimes I think it's a sin when I feel like I'm winning when I'm losing again.
Going perfectly well, and then Red actually shoots her. Oh well, I suppose it's just a day in the life of a former FBI criminal.
So long, Archie.
I think Anslow Garrick was a genuine surprise for Reddington.
Well, he probably would have been, but that was a two-parter.
What can I have to applaud and once again express huge gratitude to the legend that is Tara Bennett, because Tara, you have introduced me to a whole new exciting series, which I have managed to reach episode 16 of series 1, and there's still seasons 2 and 3 to actually go. It, of course, is The Blacklist. Why did I do this? Because of your ace book, of course, written, of course, together with last week's correspondent, Paul Terry, which I hold in my hands at this moment, Tara Bennett. Yay!
Ah, so exciting. We love to have indoctrinated a new person into the craziness of The Blacklist. So that's the highest compliment we can get, is that you actually watch the show because of the book.
Yeah,
that is awesome.
Absolutely.
You made my
Wednesday. I mean, the only thing I can actually say is clearly I have to be very careful with the book because of the spoilers, you see. And that's why I'm sort of slowly going through case by case the kind of issues. Already, I've kind of had that momentary, no, when one of the characters that I kind of thought she would probably be going and would be axed, possibly has been axed, etc. No more Parmenda. Never mind. I won't say anything more, but it's
the book is rife. It is rife with spoilers.
Yeah.
It's current with the show, just so you know, and your rewatch and anyone else that may be watching The Blacklist or have watched it, into the middle of season 2. We wrote the book with the show while they were actively writing season 2. So we finished up around the middle of season 2 in terms of canon with the show, and then the book came out 2 months later during their winter break. And so everything that's happened from February of this year until the end of the season, May, is not in the book. Hopefully, you know, people love the book, another book down the line, but it's definitely, if you're watching the show, it is spoilery until the middle of season 2.
It's very true. And again, we'll just sort of do a little bio on Elizabeth Keene's first day as an FBI profiler. The most wanted man in America gave himself up and refused to speak to anyone but her. At that moment, I thought, well, that could almost be my kind of criteria for actually doing shows on Sorry, and I will not speak to anybody other than Tara DeLulu Bennett when it comes to actually sort of quality author, as I would say with SFX. But then I have to say, I don't go around shooting people in quite the aplomb that Red does. I mean, you know, Red by name, Red by nature. It's not a good advert for gun laws, is it really?
Not very much. He relishes wiping people out far too much than I think most human beings.
Yeah. I mean, I can go with the hat. I mean, I have a sort of similar trilby myself. I can go with that. I can go with the James Spader sophologically challenged approach to life. I can go with that. But, yeah, you know, when it comes to sort of just shooting people, you know, even if they actually have Gordon Lightfoot music in the background with Sundown, you know, it's too much. Too much of a whole thing.
It's a little too much.
Yeah.
You and I can agree with each other that we'd rather read the book than wipe people out on a day-to-day basis. But yeah, it's Red is quite the character, and being able to kind of chart him in that book form was a lot of fun. You know, they obviously, the writers really relish him as a character, and being able to kind of try to explain as many mysteries as the show would even allow the audience to know, because, you know, we we definitely followed the writers of the show and their guidelines as to how much we should reveal of Red, which is why it's written from the perspective of Liz, who's the person that Red will only talk to, and yeah. It's basically her trying to kind of try to suss him out, like try to figure out in every one of their cases you may watch in the show what she's determined, what she's figured out, how she's connected some things. So, you know, even if you're someone that gets a little confused by the mythology of the show as it moves along, the book is a way to explain it all, which was really fun and challenging for Paul and I to do, and hopefully, you know, help some people go, who is that, and how do they connect to so-and-so? The book really, really gives you a very clear way of understanding all of the intricacies of the show.
When I was actually watching this, initially, my initial thought was The Blacklist. Oh, are we talking about McCarthy's Blacklist of House Un-American Committees? Are we talking about the 1950s here? Is it a historical line? And I was thinking a historical line because actually from the initial images that we saw of James Spader, I was thinking, he looks 1950s-esque. It's kind of like FBI from that perspective. So that was one line. Then I kind of caught the first episode and I'm thinking, this is a bizarre mix between Silence of the Lambs meets The X-Files meets Fringe. And then it's kind of developing its own kind of take. And, you know, hats off to some of the team that are actually there in terms of, I mean, in addition to James Spader and obviously Megan Boone, who plays Elizabeth Keane. I think it's definitely sort of found its own pace and has worked through that whole sort of sequence. So, yes, and clearly just added to by the Tara Bennett-Paul Terry epic, which is The Blacklist, Elizabeth Keane's Dossier. In keeping with the Fringe piece that you did a few years ago. And I don't know if you caught last week's sort of piece, which we did with Paul Terry, but I was very saddened with respect to that because we gave Cellescaper a nice musical airing, but Paul unfortunately had to acknowledge that I'd been all keen and excited for that wonderful online service to download my copy digitally of Big Trouble in Little China, written, of course, by yourself and Paul Terry, and they delayed the publication date.
Yeah, we're having a couple little last-minute things. You know, lawyers always like to overlook things.
It'll
be fine. Make nothing no fun sometimes. So we are just waiting for a couple things to go through their hands. We are still exceptionally proud of the final product. It has really been just a dream to be able to chart the history of that movie. It's a weird little cult movie that really was so ahead of its time in terms of so many things. Its humor, the kind of blending of genres, it's almost kind of a, you know, if you look at more of a current kind of show like a Buffy, with the horror and the humor and the, you know, referential, self-referential kind of leading hero.
It works.
Yeah,
exactly.
It just works. It's so great.
It was the role that clearly would lead to Sex and the City for at least one in the cast, and it wasn't Kurt Russell. There we are.
Exactly.
I'm just intrigued by Luke Reinhardt's quote from the current edition of SFX magazine, which I know it's an article by Jonathan Wright, this, but I did like Luke Reinhardt's quote, "I'm guilty of preaching seriously that we shouldn't take anything seriously." On a day when some of our midweek drivers have graduated, I think that possibly should have been the number one quote from that perspective. But before we go on to talk about SFX magazine and indeed some of the wonderful input that you've put together within that whole field, I can almost tell and I sense that Josh and Sean Kelly and maybe even Gary Roberts, if he's kind of managed to come out of his cloud, might be sort of wondering, what's it going to be? What's Tara's choice going to be? Will it be Men in the Sky? Will it be an early version of the work of Josh Mellor before he connected with Community? Will it actually be As the Crow Flies with Sean Kelly and The Returned Gifts? What are your thoughts, Tara Bennett?
Well, overall, I have to give major, major kudos to all three of the collectives because, you know, music is super subjective and you never know what you're going to get in terms of quality and in terms of how professional and how a well-oiled machine that certain musicians sound like. So all three of them were so lovely. Like they just really, all of them sounded like I could, you know, just, they've been working for a long time to build their sound. It's really, really polished. It's really, so kudos to all of them. And I love how eclectic they all were too. It was really cool to hear, you know, Men in Sky's kind of throwback 80s kind of electronica.
It was
really
almost
cool.
Back in the day, back in those Big Trouble in Little China, really.
Absolutely. I was like, you know, this is, I was immediately put back into when I was listening to all new wave pop with my Walkman, and, you know, but it definitely had a new sound to it as well. They've definitely not just gone retro. They've definitely kind of melded that older electronica with a very new kind of dance beat, which is really cool. I really enjoyed Community. I'm a sucker for a great male singer-songwriter voice. And so I really enjoyed his song as well. And then Sean, and I listened to part of his last interview, the Sean Kelly and the Return Gifts. What a great musicianship. I really enjoyed that video. So it was like, wow, this is actually going to be a tough call. So I think I would definitely, I think I'm going to give it to Sean and the Return Gifts.
That I really enjoyed. As the crow flies. Excellent.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the kind of rockling, you know, the energy of that song was really wonderful. I really enjoyed how they married together their visuals with that song as well, you know, knowing how hard it is to make a video these days with, you know, low budgets, but to be able to really infuse all of elements of it, from music to visuals to everything else together. So kudos to them. That would be my choice.
Well, Tara, this is fantastic. I'm not sure whether Larry Nemechek, our Star Trek correspondent, will actually sort of have a couple of things to say as well, but that's fantastic. Tara, already I think you've echoed the assembled multitudes say, well done, Sean Kelly, not only for actually answering the telephone, which is important when you're doing live features with artists. I don't want to make any bones about it. You know, it's just, if you set the thing, it's important. Something could have cropped up. We know all sorts of things can actually have. Hopefully all positive from that point of view, but good to see that that's there. Now, if we can actually move on to this next sort of line, which states, time travel movie tearjerker gets a gender twist. And I do remember Frequency, the heartbreaker of a movie with Dennis Quaid and Jim Caviezel as father and son able to communicate through time via ham radio. So is this one of those areas which you're thinking, actually, this could be the kind of sleeper that executive producer Jeremy Carver is saying that, yeah, this could be a winner because it's not father-son, it's father-daughter?
Yeah, it's a pretty cool twist. I like that, you know, that it's really not trying to just kind of chase what that original movie did, you know, quite a while ago. I remember reviewing that movie and doing a screening for it with another place that I worked eons ago. And so... you know, to see that one get reworked, and time travel is a huge theme this year in American television. There's this one. There's another one called Timeless. There's another one of my favorite. It's a Nicholas Meyer movie called Time After Time, which hopefully you remember in a scene with Malcolm McDowell.
Indeed.
About a
precursor before
going back in time.
Yeah, before he did Wrath of Khan, of course.
Exactly, and that one is getting a modern update too. So, you know, we definitely have, if you like time travel is definitely the theme du jour of this fall and the upcoming mid-season in January. And then also going back to properties that maybe haven't been addressed again and redoing them in the television medium, because as we know as well, you know, it was a little bit of a rough year for movies in terms of people really liking all the sequels, but you've got a lot of great movie ideas from the past that are not just going to theaters and remakes, they're coming to television. Mm-hmm. And so Frequency definitely seems to me, based on, you know, having watched part of the pilot and having the caliber of the writers, Jeremy Carver for quite some time worked on Supernatural. He took over the show from Eric Kripke when he left, and he also did the American version of Being Human. So he's got a nice, really strong history with ensemble cast, with character-oriented TV shows, and genre. So that's another really great thing running for Frequency as well, is that he knows the genre and how to meld character and human stories together with a high concept, which is definitely this whole talking through time between the father and the daughter. And it'll be interesting, you know, I always am interested to see how, you know, a two-hour movie, cut and dry, you get your story, you get your resolution. Sometimes with high concept things, it's always interesting to say, how long can you keep doing that? You know, how long will that last before I start getting either tired of the idea, or they've created a really creative way to move forward with it? And so that would be the thing that I'm most interested in seeing, is how it develops with the characters, how much I really love them, and then how long can this concept go over an extended period of time, which is, you know, the heart of how a television show, you know, exists.
Tara, stay with us for about 80 seconds because we've got a theme from a TV series which, from my own perspective, I always feel actually reminds me very much of your good self. this up in the sky? Is it Helen Slater? Is it Melissa Benoist? No, it's Tara Bennett. It's Supergirl. Yay!
I'll take that. Thank you, sir.
There we are. Exactly. I know Joseph McCabe tends to snatch most of the superhero stuff, with Gotham, of course, being an honourable exception from that point of view. But I think Melissa Benoist and your good self, all you need is an episode where she looks after otters and it's all sorted. That's the key thing.
Honestly, I don't know why they haven't gotten to that episode yet. I agree with you. If they do that, you know, then, you know, they've got a viewer for life with me. So.
Exactly. You got your red kryptonite. You got the return of Superman into the series. You got, obviously, shifting to a channel, which means you can potentially have crossovers with the Arrow, with the Legends of Tomorrow,
yeah,
and the Flash, and so on. But strangely enough, not Gotham as yet. Well, maybe that's understandable. Because, again, we started off with The Blacklist. Gotham also somewhat bleak at times, somewhat nihilistic.
Yes. They're definitely going for the much darker tone. Its color palette is so much darker, so much different than the Cape shows that you were just mentioning. The tone, you know, Arrow gets dark. I think that, you know, that Arrow is the one that's closest in terms of sometimes touching upon the darkness that Gotham likes to explore. But I think Gotham's definitely a show, especially through Jim Gordon, that's exploring you know, somebody with a moral compass that is really sucked into the corruption that is at the heart of Gotham. And it's really a show about exploring the pantheon of villains, you know, that have come out of the Batman DC universe, and being able to show how they've started, interesting things like they've been tracking Enigma and him really becoming the Riddler, and watching us, you know, him again being this kind of just general nerd kind of a guy that works for the police, and then now, you know, seeing his own mania kind of slowly crawl through him so that we can understand, you know, when he becomes the Riddler, what that path was. So definitely a show that, and that's the thing that I always have been most attracted to with Gotham, is that, you know, we've seen the origin story of Bruce Wayne, although David, who plays the young Bruce Wayne in this show, has done a really great job in making that version, the pre-Batman Bruce Wayne, interesting. But I've always found, you know, a show where you go from the villain's perspective is just finally a different way of telling the story. It's, you know, in some ways you could even say, you know, Suicide Squad this summer in the theaters is, you know, kind of ripping off of that as well. Let's move away from the term ripping off when you're talking about Suicide Squad,
because the number of legal writs that are going through that sort of system. Whenever the behind the scenes book of Suicide Squad is written, I'm sure there'll be lots of sort of delays on that one. But we'll hold fire on that. That's another issue entirely.
You're right.
We will need to go to the wonderful Larry Nemechek, because we are literally hours away from formally celebrating 50 years of Star Trek the TV series. Yes, the date has arrived.
Oh,
yeah, I know, it's very exciting. But have you had a reason?
So excited.
Exactly. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the program today, Tara Bennett?
Absolutely, that's my favorite phone call of the day.
Well, there we are. Don't forget the Blacklist, Elizabeth Keane's dossier, Tara Bennett and Paul Terry. Plus, of course, what we talked about a couple of weeks ago, which, of course, was the fabulous Art of Ice Age, also available. Plus SFX magazine with Luke Cage bursting through the front cover, and lots of Tara Bennett pieces of wonderful thing in there. Plus, of course, Richard Edwards and the rest of the SFX crew. Have you all set for... Let me rewind that again. Are you going to be joining us again in the very near future, sometime in October?
Yes, sir, please. I would love to.
Hooray!
Hey, this is Larry Nemechek, Dr. Trek, and you're listening to the Midweek Drive.
And the shocking, I say again, shocking news from Nemechek Towers in the joys of California is Larry Nemechek will not be at Star Trek Europe destination, Star Trek Europe, on the 7th and 9th of October 2016, the NEC Birmingham. Larry, I think we should cancel the event now, to be honest. I mean, you know, it's... Well, you know, I mean, I'm already thinking about maybe I should just return the pass that I was sort of considering going, because I thought, you know, we'd go there as it worked through that. But without Larry Nemechek, good grief. I mean, you got Jonathan Frakes, Will Wheaton, George Takei, certain William Shatner's there, Christopher Lloyd, Marina Sirtis, Walter Koenig, Robert Duncan. No Larry Nemechek, it's pointless. You know, just stop it now. Anyway, I've made my point, I made my feeling clear.
I hate to be the one to break it to you, Alex. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
They were kind enough to have me at the last one and possibly the next one then. But no, don't let that interfere with your partying and your celebration.
Now, we have to acknowledge that infinite diversity in infinite combinations, it does continue. And as we've been saying, again, we were talking with Tara Bennett, she's very excited. We're all very excited because, yes, the original series that sort of led to so many inspiring lines and indeed, of course, the upcoming Star Trek Discovery with Rod Roddenberry are also finding out, even though on a recent BBC Radio 4 programme, Rod Roddenberry, Gene's son, actually said that back in the day, he was much more of a Starsky and Hutch fan than Star Trek. Yeah. I mean, you know, Kirk and Spock, Starsky and Hutcherson, there's a kind of connection there. Captain Doby is possibly Scotty, but I think you're stretching it if you say, I can't get this red Torino to work, Captain. I can't get this red Torino to work.
That's a stretch.
Yeah.
Yes.
But, you know... I'm
trying to figure out where Huggy Bear fits in, but anyway.
I would have seen him possibly as Ensign Chekhov, you know, a kind of Chekhov, a kind of combination of Chekhov and Sulu would be the Huggy Bear sort of character.
A comedy relief there, right.
But don't get me started on the Starsky and Hutch movie with Owen Wilson, because, again, I thought, no. Anyway, at least
I
they did have kind
of, I won't.
Yeah, no, it's so what have you been up to, Larry, since last we spoke a couple of months ago, whilst the Trek universe was continuing to manifest its excitement? Star Trek Beyond has kind of been with us. We've loved the whole thing. You know, the fact that it's, you know, references so many wonderful Easter eggs of the actual sort of show, feeling kind of episodic. I thought it went well. We've had a kind of suggestion that despite the fact that figures haven't been as great as they'd hoped, there will be a fourth movie in which, yes, Thor the Thunder God meets James T. Kirk.
What more could you want?
Exactly.
Yeah. No, it's good to be back with you today, Alex, but it's been a full summer. That's what got in the way. We've been celebrating all over the place, and I've been lucky enough to be at several of the big conventions. Not Destination coming up, unfortunately, but it's been a summer long.
And on the flip side,
the
Larry,
for me was the big Vegas.
Yeah, uh-huh. I was going to say, surely the highlight would have been Scarborough, you know, the Vegas by the sea.
Scarborough was a highlight for me. That was a lot of fun. But it was nothing to compare to like the Vegas convention and the big San Diego Comic-Con, which is the granddaddy of all the Comic-Cons here. There was a huge Star Trek influence for the first time ever. And it's conventions large and small, and people have been. There are many more conventions that are all everybody is emphasizing Star Trek.
Yeah.
How many times do you get a 50th anniversary, right?
Well, just once, really, because that's the whole purpose. I mean, the next one will be 60th and 70th and 100th and other sort of actors from that. It is interesting,
right,
though, insofar as clearly some of the conventions are massive business. I mean, you know, I'm not knocking Destination Star Trek, and I will obviously we'll be going there to just sort of hopefully soak up the atmosphere and so on. But I did think, and I can understand, shall we say, one or two people thinking, what, £80? £80 for a photograph with William Shatner? That's $160. You know, an admiral package of £3,000. There are moments where you think, interesting, but you know, each to their own. I suppose you could argue, well, what about sports fans? They spend similar sums as well.
Right. That's been the great liberation here the last 10-20 years, is equating, you know, geek fandoms and Star Trek fans with sports fans. It's all fandom. It's all getting people passionate about what they like. But look at them all the same. They are, you know, they got, in American football, the guys that I love to say it's 30 degrees below zero and they're out in the end zone with, you know, topless with their bellies painted blue, you know, whatever. And that's supposed to be goofy and crazy, but heaven forbid somebody at a science fiction convention do the same thing, and that's strange. No, it's all fun. It's all good.
Yeah. And at least people aren't shooting themselves or shooting other people, which is even worse. So, you know, either for that sort of our official line with respect to gun laws, it's bad enough if you shoot yourself, but don't shoot anybody else. Oh, you can have that as a quote if you wish. Does,
okay.
You know, I think in the run-up to the presidential election, it could be the winner. I don't say the winner for whom, but you know, it could be a winner. So, again, in terms of the... I mean, how was Vegas? Because we also had the joy of having a little visit to the Vegas of the Northeast, or the Northwest, with Blackpool, and we're still actually working on, hopefully, hosting one of these programmes live from the NCC-1701 Enterprise Bridge, which we've been offered to do there with the Star Trek exhibition that's going on at Blackpool. How was Vegas in terms of comparison? Because for many years, Vegas and Star Trek kind of were... It was like Elvis and Vegas, David Cassidy and Vegas, Star Trek and Vegas. It was pretty big business, really, if only for the gold press Latinum.
Right, well, it was only after they built the Star Trek Experience with the ride and the museum and all of that, the shops and the Quark's Bar in 1997. So the next 10 years, that was a big attraction, but no one thought to do a convention there until 2001. And then the creation one had been going since 2002, first at the Hilton, and then when the Experience went away, they moved it over to the Rio. But it's gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. There was a time, you know, about the time Enterprise was canceled, that things seemed to be treading water a little bit. They weren't, we didn't know what was going to happen with fandom in Star Trek. But 4 or 5 years ago, the new J.J. movies, J.J. Abrams movies helped this, but just the fact that the fan films and the remastered and the Netflix access, the streaming service access, just really, you know, rebirth Star Trek. So now we've got Brian Fuller's new series. It's got people excited. And the bottom line was, this being the 50th year, the Vegas convention and all the hotels around there sold out, which I never thought I would live to ever see. That was just an insane time. And we had fans from all over the world, a lot of people who said, well, if I'm ever going to go, I'm going to do it for the 50th. And it wasn't quite the train wreck, you know, just the so much human flesh crammed into so much space. It wasn't quite as bad as I was expecting, but it was certainly a big show, and CBS went all out, as did Creation, put on a great, great show. And then having said that, I wasn't able to attend, but the Mission New York show with a different company, Reed Pop, in New York, that just happened, went down as a big hit too. So a lot of good work by the licensed shows, and a lot of good work by all the conventions that are making sure to have a lot of Star Trek programming this year, a lot of Star Trek highlights.
And, of course, we've just heard on Facebook by one of our semi-regular correspondents, in fact, it's high time she joined us back again, Celeste Yarnell, that Star Trek stamps are now available. So even the mail has actually got involved with the whole process. So it's just sensational after sensation. Larry, there's so much more we still need to talk about, but I'm conscious that we've got Phil Leonis, our ace director, somewhere in the wilderness of California with a mobile phone, probably waiting for a single. So, or even a signal. Have you had a recently interesting telephonic link with us on the program today?
I have been. I'm so glad to say hi before the 50th anniversary night, tomorrow night, the actual celebration.
This is it, exactly.
I was glad to be able to pop in again once more.
So the next critical thing is, will you be with us as we count down to 51, 52? Will you be back with us in a couple of weeks' time and hopefully sort of keep us appraised of the goodness and joy that infinite diversity in infinite combinations can bring to the world?
I would be happy to be your messenger, Alex.
Yay!
Hey there, everybody. I'm filmmaker, podcaster, California State Certified Violence Prevention Specialist, and podiatrist to the stars, Phil Leonis. And I've been proud to be a U.S. cultural correspondent for Alex Lefchuk's Midweek Drive program for many years now. And I congratulate you, dear listener, on having found this oasis of podcast audio magic in the cosmos, or on your internet-equipped mobile device, or your computer, or... I
stepped outside the backstage door to breathe some nicotine. I don't need a wristband. My axe is on the bandstand. My band is on the floor. I need an orchestra.
I know you might be hiking through the woods with a Keep Calm, I'm the Doctor t-shirt on, but have you got a wristband, Phil Leonis? And if you ain't got a wristband, you ain't coming in here.
I had a wristband this weekend at the Sausalito Arts Festival.
Nice.
I was a VIP guest of Marin Magazine, and I was plied with expensive champagne.
Very good.
All sorts of delicacies. Yeah, so I've been known to sport a wristband or two in my life.
Well, as Paul Simons again captured the moment from his latest album, of course, Wristband. You don't get in here if you're not wearing a wristband, even though, as he said himself in that semi-autobiographical song, he was actually performing on stage. Never mind. It's ironic. Earlier in the programme, quite apart from the triple whammy of Men in the Sky, Josh from Community and Sean Kelly, ultimately decided by Tara Bennett to be the winner of the little musical challenge we had with As the Crow Flies. Of course, Larry Nemechek, who, thankfully, I didn't rely on Larry to actually listen to the pieces because he's been so busy with Star Trek, he couldn't have time to do that. So it was all sorted through from that. But we mentioned the words bewilderingly bad. And we mentioned those words because they are the words that Richard Fitzwilliams has used to describe a particular movie. If you haven't caught the show, Phil, and if you're in the middle of the woods, why would you? Unless you've brought it along as a podcast, which you'd have to sort of time travel, and we'd be into all sorts of complexes for that. Do you know which movie he might have been referring to with those words, bewilderingly bad?
Well, I mean, see, this is like shooting fish in the barrel. I mean, there's no shortage. There's no shortage of choices.
Oh.
Not knowing exactly what's a recent release there, I'm a little at a loss. But please regale me.
If I said the actor Morgan Freeman has a major role in this, would that help?
Oh, is it the Ben-Hur remake?
Yeah. I know.
I don't think Morgan Freeman actually does have a major role in it, does he? I mean, like, all the leads are played by unknowns.
But Phil, that's like saying Jared Leto doesn't have a major role in Suicide Squad, for goodness sakes. Anyway.
So this was the big budget attempt to again capture the evangelical audience here that Mel Gibson proved existed all those years ago with Passion of the Christ. And he's doing a sequel,
yes,
of course.
Resurrection.
Of the Christ. Yeah, that's not even a joke. I mean, it sounds
exactly
like we're so setting up for a joke, but we're not. We'll tell jokes later so people can tell the difference. But this was the latest attempt by Hollywood to do it, and it was bankrolled by Mark Burnett, who is a reality show czar, created Survivor and other
classics.
That I've never watched.
If you've never watched them, Phil,
and his wife, right? His wife is Roma Downey, who starred in Touched by an Angel.
Yes.
And they produced this. They financed this thing.
Yeah. You've got Carrie Drury writing Cell 7, her latest dystopian text, which emerges on September 22nd. But it's fair to say, Phil, who Richard, easily confused, Richard Fitzwilliams? Phil Leonis. Let's just separate them out. One based in California, one based in London, England. Richard was cited on BBC Radio 4, so it was a national, international broadcasting station, did a piece last Sunday, sent me a link, and he's going to be reviewing it tomorrow on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. Obviously, contractual agreements apply from that point of view. But some of the quotes that we actually had here, no dignity, nonsense, bewilderingly bad, and the ultimate quote, as indeed Sam Goldwyn said, widescreen just makes a bad film twice as bad.
I'm just relieved that it's not my film, The Lady Killers. Of course, you can tell the difference. Oh, it's between me and Richard Fitzwilliams Because I'm the one that doesn't refuse to watch The Lady Killers.
Well, there you are, exactly. And, of course, there are any there are no chariot races in The Lady Killers. Spoiler alert. There we are.
Got cut out. That scene did get cut out, yes.
I thought it needed a bit of chariot. Never mind. It's a DVD extras. That's what we look for from that point of view. Phil, would you like to hear the winning song in the selection that Tara Bennett decided of the three tunes we played earlier? This was her choice as the one that effectively did it for her. It was all very well talking about Men in the Sky, MITS version 2.0, working on that for 40 years, since the 1980s. No, it was all very well talking about Josh Mellor and his little corner of the earth, which is very nice, but Sean Kelly and his particular band of, to be precise, The Returned Gifts.
You know that you wrote, you sent out little bit of homework.
I did, yes.
But not only with links, you described the songs, you described the artists.
Yes.
And I would, and if I had been a betting man, and I am not a betting man, but if I had been a betting man, I would have bet from what you sent that it was Sean Kelly and As the Crow Flies that would be the winner, which makes me think that perhaps how you wrote about these songs tilted the odds in the favor of Sean Kelly, because that was what I remembered after reading the email.
The thoughts of that, very interesting, but I have to hold my hand up, in fact, both hands up, and say, I did not write that press release. That was written by Tony McDonough from Manila PR. I simply sort of acted as a conduit to share that press release.
So I am sure As the Crow Flies is a worthy song. I'm about to hear it. Mm-hmm. I'm also thinking that there might be some corruption in the PR.
I'm coming home to you. Nothing's gonna slow me down. Except I'm rolling through. I've been too long out of town. No more chasing tails and staring at the skies. Straight as a die. And as the crow flies.
Tell me that doesn't make you want to skip through Montalvo in a wonderful estate of mind for Linus.
That was all sorts of awesome. And for some reason, it brought to mind a little town that we discovered on our road trip up the California coast. A town with a population of 17. And it is a vigorously maintained population of 17, which seems very scary. Like, they absolutely curb the population limit at 17. But we saw what looked like an old West town approaching in the distance. And, like, it was a theme town, only it's not. It's a town that was built in the 1880s, one block in length, 2.5 acres is the size of this town. The name of the town is Harmony, which brought to mind the Great Prisoner episode set in the Old West, Living in Harmony.
With Alexis Denisov.
Kanner, Alexis Kanner.
Thank you. I was bemused by the Brickfield. Yes, carry on.
So this town was recently bought by someone here in Los Angeles. Someone owns this town. And the residents are quite hopeful that this new owner will be able to get the post office reopened. It's been closed since 2004. But it's a magnificent little artist's colony. But I want to share with you two tidbits. One, this town actually once elected as mayor a Maine Coon cat, which I think is appropriate because a Maine Coon is the largest of the domestic cats, so it could really shoulder a large burden. The other thing is it's famous for inventing what is called the Doodah Parade. And this is a parade where, because of the fact that the town is only one block long, so there is nowhere for the parade participants to actually march to, the parade participants all march in place throughout the day, and the people who have come, the spectators in attendance, actually walk around them throughout the duration of the parade. So I think a live report for Siren FM from the next Utah parade is very much in order. By the way, your friends at the Los Angeles Zoo will be speaking next week at the Los Angeles Breakfast Club. So indeed, bringing communities together. It's Alex Lefchuk and the Midweek Drive.
And I'm just looking at the Breakfast Club's famous cryptogram, the Shrine of Friendship. F-V-N-E-M, S-V-F-M, F-V-N-E-X, S-V-F-X, O-I-C-V-F-M-N-X. It's all Greek to me.
Rule number one of the cryptogram is you don't talk about
it. There you are, you see. And I just smashed that into the ether as we've spoken. Thanks certainly to Camo for launching the whole sequence. Hadn't realised that Camo had not had the pleasure of meeting Lily Holliman because apparently Lily couldn't actually get up in time when you went off and met him, Phil Leonis. But that's okay. That's all right. Yeah,
we were a couple of bachelors, a couple of rogues out on the road. Yeah. Early morning, mixing up trouble in Nashville.
Yeah. As I say, we were already just talking with Larry Nemechek about how Rod Roddenberry's favourite TV series growing up was indeed Starsky and Hutch, not Star Trek, despite his familiar connection from that whole point of view. And indeed, Larry and myself were ruminating, as you can hear on the podcast when we publish it, on ways in which possibly you could have a kind of combination of Kirk and Spock as Starsky and Hutch, Captain Doby as Scotty, and indeed the ultimate combination of Chekhov and Sulu as Huggy Bear. I just roll that out for your next kind of creative offering, maybe at the Los Angeles Breakfast Club, or maybe another movie. Trent throws us out there three. It's gone very quiet now.
Are we still on the air right now?
Thanks to William Coles, Carrie Drury, Gary Roberts, Josh. Well, actually, Gary Roberts, who didn't quite answer his phone, but thanks to Men in the Sky, Josh and Sean Kelly and Tari Bennett and Larry Nemechek. Phil Leonis, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the program today?
When do we get started?
No, always nice. We did get a thank you note and a well done note from Emma Tinson and Claire Margerison and Mary Dancy, who have just been through their graduation ceremony. So there we are. They have now formally graduated.
Oh, congratulations. Oh, very exciting. Has Katie Grimason heard ident that we did? Yeah.
Yes, very good indeed. I like it. Saving it for the right moment. But yes, I think we need to repeat that. You know, graduation doesn't mean the end of... It's the beginning of something new. It's a whole new exciting scenario on that basis. As indeed Tessa Snart will allude to when she connects us with Spain tomorrow morning, all being well. So I take it you'll be back next week then, Phil Leonis?
I shall return.
We didn't even squeeze in a Mike Dooley thought from the universe. Still, it's been that kind of packed show. Congratulations once again to Sean Kelly with As the Crow Flies, despite Phil's scurrilous lines that it was all, I mean, it's persuasive literature. You know, don't shoot the messenger. It's you.
No, I am not saying it didn't deserve to win. It was a Cracker Jack song. I'm saying I knew it was going to win based on the press release.
Exactly. You see, you could be taking us all the way back to Tara Bennett's book On the Blacklist with James Spader, and then you know, all sorts of things would actually happen. Good series. A little unsolved scenario. Have you caught The Blacklist at all, Phil?
I'm a gigantic James Spader fan. He's always been one of my favorite actors.
There you are.
It is not a great series. It has found its footing in the last year, especially after James Spader became an executive producer and really started using his power to start shaping the storyline.
I'm only up to episode 16 of season 1, Phil, so I have to keep it very real at that particular moment.
You have that to look forward to. It's always nice when, in this day and age, a show finds its footing and gets better as it goes along, because I think all too often we have the opposite happen, where we see a first couple episodes and we think, wow, this is going to be really good, and then it's downhill from there. This is a show that's getting better as it unfolds.
Unlike Chilpack Hollywood Hour and The Midweek Drive, which, as you know, mature to greatness with chronological giftedness, we get better with age. That's it. Thank you, dear listener, for being part of the whole thing. Yes,
I think after 10 years, Chilpack Hollywood Hour, we're almost done with our practice shows and we're ready to get started.
There we are. Say goodnight, Phil.
Good night, Phil.
But I never let you. I needed you. You didn't.